I was there the day Horus slew the Emperor.
Hello and welcome to the Iterators Podcast, a podcast about the Horus Heresy game system for the hobby, gaming, and lore enthusiast. My name is Daniel and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host Josh.
What is up, everybody?
All right, and I'd like to welcome back onto the podcast the team leader of the Panoptica team, as well as the moderator, the main moderator for the major Horus Heresy Discord server.
Right.
So please welcome onto the podcast, Ollie, or as he's better known on Discord and on social media, Code Walrus.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
All right, and so for today, I'm really excited for this episode because we're going to be talking about Panoptica. Mm-hmm. And as y'all may know, we're really big fans of Panoptica. Yep. On this podcast, brought it into our local gaming group. We think the Panoptica team has brought so much onto the platform to really bring it to life, really. And so one big thing that I'm really excited about today is that from our last episode till this episode, mm-hmm. the Panoptica team has been really, really busy.
They put out a lot of really good content.
Absolutely. So Ollie, why don't you explain a little bit, just briefly, what y'all have been doing over the past few months from our last interview?
Yeah, so since we last spoke, we've managed to get our Mechanicum book out, Liber Ingenium. We've also done a pretty big look over for the Marines book, just to rebalance that, Liber Centura. We've then done a pretty sweeping large-scale update of the Panoptica, which is now in its fourth version. And we've released our Eldar book, Liber Antiqua, which has been really well received.
Absolutely. And so I love all the things that have been, the changes that have been made and all the updates. And that's one big thing about Panoptica that I really respect about what y'all do, is that it's always about taking the user feedback, whether it be the new units, whether it be changes that are made from the original 30K rule set, the Age of Darkness rule set, and then saying, okay, cool, this is the great framework, and we don't want to change the game mm-hmm. itself. We don't want to, like, oh, we're going to insert our own thing here and, you know, screw GW. It's like, no. How can we enhance that project? How can we enhance the game, again, to bring life to the heresy?
Yeah, 100%. And I also think, like, from my perspective, one of the things that I'm really looking forward to is the campaign system. You mentioned a lot of the additions to now version 4.0 of Panoptica. And, like, I think that what the work that you guys have done, particularly in the realm of the campaign system, is going to really bring games of heresy around the nation, well, around, you know, the nations, right? bring those games, like, have that whole new level of
You're talking about the 30K nation.
Yeah, the 30K nation.
We're our people, right?
100%. But, like, I think that's going to really lead to massive creativity increases. And I'm really looking forward to that. Our community is actually about to start something with that here coming up, which I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk more about in the future. But very selfishly, I'm very thankful for that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So what we're going to be doing as far as, like, the overview of the episode is the new missions mm-hmm. System in Panoptica, yep. what they brought. So there's going to be a lot more new missions.
Right.
As well as a crusade system
yes.
that they've developed so that you can then bring the story to life. That's what we always talk about here on the mm-hmm. podcast. We always talk about your boys, bringing your boys to life. Also, but getting that and then, hey, how can we take that to the next level? Panoptica has a system to help you, or I should say assist you, bringing that to the next level.
Yes.
And so that would be part one. Part two, what we're going to be talking about is Ingenium, which is we're bringing that 40K ad mech to the 30K Mechanicum, all the changes that have made with that, and really what it took to turn 40K ad mech mm-hmm. into 30K to expand upon the range that's already there and to help flesh out the story that you want to tell on the tabletop. And then part three, which I'm, again, extremely excited to talk about, is Antiquia. That is the Eldar that's going to be brought to that 30K. It is the Xenos. Again, there's a lot of talk about, hey, you know, one of the big things we always hear all the time is, oh, well, you know, 30K is very human-centric. You know, what about my Eldar? What about my Xenos? Well, Panoptica, the Panoptica team has heard that and says, hey, you know what? Let's bring that to 30K, because it's not like they weren't there.
No.
You know, and so we're going to get all into those all those great details and everything like that in each respective part. And so I can't wait. So if you want to hear more about that, stay right up and we'll get right to that. All right, so for part one, we're talking about any of the changes that were made to Panoptica. More specifically, and what I'm honestly most excited about, is mission design and the Crusade system. Mm-hmm. So, Ollie, why don't you explain to me what are the changes you've made to Panoptica in regards to the mission set, and also, what is the Crusade system, and why is that? Why did you see that as an important addition to 30K?
Okay, so the missions themselves, if we start there, they break down into three categories. So we've added some standard missions, some apocalypse missions, and some Zomatalis missions. Anybody who's been playing Heresy since 1.0, or even playing 40k back in its kind of 7th, or 6th, or even 5th editions, will look at the core missions that are now in the Heresy 2.0 rulebook and will recognize them. At their core, they've managed to stay largely unchanged for over 10 years.
Right.
They've become a little bit played out, a little bit stale as a result. And a lot of people feel that way, myself included. They're good, fun missions. They're well tested at this point, but there's nothing new there. There's no new ground you can retrod. So if we start with looking at the standard missions we did, we decided that we wanted to introduce some more unique scenarios that give players a chance to explore different methods of waging war, and different parts of that you can build out with. So things like new secondary objectives and new primary objectives, new mission special rules and so on, as well as things like fixed deployment maps to encourage you to actually build into that mission a certain way.
Right.
And that's kind of culminated in 12 standard missions that kind of really push you down that alleyway.
Right. And one thing that I find very, what I like of what y'all did is, yeah, you're right. There are the missions, don't get me wrong, the 6 missions are fun and all. Mm-hmm. But there's only so much story that you can tell with those 6 missions.
Right.
And so we get a lot of messages from the Iterators podcast from listeners regarding, hey, you know what? I really want to tell my story. I want to help develop my story. Mm-hmm. Right. But again, there's only these 6 core missions in the rule book. Mm-hmm. And I want to tell XYZ story.
Right.
And a lot of times people find that quite limiting. So one thing that's really interesting, and then, you know, we go through that process if I tell them, hey, have you ever considered this, try to do these type of missions, or maybe look in history to like and try to replicate those sort of missions. Mm-hmm. Onto the tabletop, right? And these are very conceptual. I'm not giving advice that's like, oh, well, these are the you know, the meta elements of the mission. I'm not really going pen and paper and writing it out with them.
Right, right.
You know, and fully fleshing out a mission with them. I don't know about you, Josh, but for me, a lot of times when I'm responding to these, I always try to, you know, give these conceptual, ideas to, mm-hmm. to listeners to help them flesh out the story with their local gaming group so that they can then tell the story of their boys and beyond what the 6 mission sets that are given within 30K. A lot of times I always refer back to the black books, mm-hmm. but again, those are very hard to get a hold of.
Yeah.
I mean, they're...
Well, and a lot of people, it's not really worth, like, I won't say it's not worth it, but like they're not going to put forth that level of investment, right? Particularly if they're newer, they're learning about the heresy, they're getting involved and whatnot. It's just, they're not at that point yet. Right.
Right.
And so one of the things that I think how you said it, Walrus, was really good is like, you're sort of pushing a specific narrative. And I know we've talked before about, I think we had an episode where we discussed the Battle of Agincourt. Right. And so, if you look at a lot of historical battles, the terrain and the circumstance is what actually dictates that battle occurring at that time, right? Like,
right.
Through most of, you know, particularly looking at medieval history, like, armies reposition, they skirmish, there's not that full head-on engagement, right? Because it's so disadvantageous to both sides, right?
Right.
That if you're the side that has the, you know, definitely the stronger perspective, then you want to have that fight, right? Now, if you're the side in the weaker perspective, you don't want to have that fight. So you're doing everything you can to evade,
well,
to skirmish.
It's those points of interest, right?
Exactly.
Because, I mean, you're looking at one person, and I had this conversation 10 years ago or so. I was talking to someone who made a comment about Warhammer generally, Warhammer 40K, 30K fights.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, the one thing I don't like about the Warhammer setting and is that fights just kind of happen randomly. They don't really happen over like a point of interest. And I was rebuttaling that specifically when a 30K setting. But he was, a lot of times he was saying, you know, to your point, Josh, was that he was like, well, you know, they're fighting over random void area, you know, XYZ, which has no significance. And in reality, and you're right, Josh, that isn't somewhere where you would have that fight, right?
Well,
why
life,
are you going to waste your resources out in the middle of nowhere, you know? The disposition of your troops, that's a commodity. That's a resource, right? Why are you there?
And in the front lines of battle, that resource can be so valuably used in so many different areas,
right?
That to commit them to one specific point, unless it like deemed absolutely necessary, you never are going to do that.
Exactly. And a good example, and again, I hate going back to World War II because, you know, I think we always bring that up randomly, but it's like, you know, when you're looking at like, you know, the Germans on the southern and the eastern front on the southern, Southern Army, right? They were pushing towards the oil fields, right? In the Caucasus, right? And that was their primary objective. Go for the oil fields, because we need oil for the war effort, right?
Yep.
And then all of a sudden they got distracted and they go, well, Stalingrad, kind of interesting. Let's go over there as well. And then we can get a moral victory over there,
right?
But you got to remember that they had to split their forces
to
go over there. You know, Southern Army Group had to go over there to go then try to grab that, you know, to grab Stalingrad on the Volga. And then, you know, they also made some, well, you know, Volga River, that's a vital shipping hub that goes up and down, blah, blah. And they were trying to justify, which in reality was just a moral victory. What they were trying to grab is a quote unquote easy moral victory.
Right.
When in reality, they were just. That's what it was going on. Or I should say that was the reality of the situation. But getting back to 30K and getting back to what Ollie was talking about in Panoptica is that it's very, very hard to try to tell that compelling story of the heresy in all of its forms, whether it's Istvan 3, Istvan 5, Beta Garmin, the Siege of Terra, Siege of Chthonia, which granted Siege of Chthonia has their own mission set, and you know, so maybe that's not a good example, but there's all these battles that occurred and engagements in theaters of operation that aren't spoken about in detail. What the Panoptica team does is they expand upon that general rule set, not something that is specific to the theater of operations of that particular battle. Like, let's just say, like the Siege of Chthonia. Okay, the missions in there can be used generally speaking with the Apex missions, you know, but generally they're kind of revolve around that, right?
Right.
But what Walrus does and what the Panoptica team does more specifically is they go, okay, hey, what if you want to get generic rule set? Right? Generic missions. And let's apply that to anything that anyone could do. And that's what I think is awesome, especially in particular with what Ollie does. And so Ollie, I do have a question for you is, you know, when you're developing these missions, what goes through your mind when you are with a team, I should say, when you're going, okay, we have to create generic mission set. How can that be applied to a multitude of different quote unquote theaters, AKA each individual's local gaming group?
So when we start approaching kind of the mission design in general, one of the first things we try and look at is what would be the purpose of this? So you touched on it earlier about obviously these are very small battles and maybe these resources could be used somewhere else better. But to my mind, it's more about your 3,000 points on the table might look like a lot, but this is a key point in the line where the line breaks. This is the decision point.
Right.
So you're probably representing something that, if you could put it into a points value, might be 1,000,000 points. But your 3,000 points, that is the tip of the spear. That is the edge of the line. That is where it all comes down, or where it's held. And so our missions that we designed, particularly between me and a couple of the team members that were really on point with the mission design, was what would cause such an important decision point? What would be the reason why the line would have to be held here or would have to be broken here?
Right.
And so that's usually what we would then do is design that scenario, figure out how that might work on the table, and then build the mission around that primary objective, and then scatter in some secondary objectives that we feel are appropriate. Typically then, that mission then goes off to the playtesters, and the team will be testing it for a couple of weeks or a couple of months until we're satisfied and it's been through a few revisions, and then it goes in the book.
What, just for the listener here, what would maybe be an example of like one of the missions that you are the most pleased with, and how kind of like, what was the initial like inspiration for that? And then how did it, you know, turn out in its final form?
So I'll probably actually pick the very first mission, Foothold, that we've got in there, the standard mission pack. So what Foothold does is a little bit different. It forces the game to deploy using the Dawn of War deployment map, so those are the standard lengthways deployments. But then, to score your victory points, you actually need to control quadrants. So most quadrant scoring game modes usually are encouraging you to deploy in quadrants. This forces you to deploy one way and then score another. So that is a much different kind of almost conversation that you're having through, you know, telling the narrative of the game, of you have to start way, way back in your lines and you're working your way forward. The more land you control at the end, the better. It also brings in some secondary objectives that are, in my opinion, notably missing from the core game. So First Strike of, you know, destroying units is one that used to be a core book mission, secondary objective. Mm-hmm. It's gone. It's missing. As well as Big Game Hunter, which is basically a reward for taking out your opponent's Death Star or their, you know, their big powerful unit.
Right.
Bring that down, you get an extra VP.
Yep.
So it's a much different way of scoring the game, and that kind of unique way of forcing the game to be played, I think, is really quite fun and quite engaging. And that shows, I think, through a lot of the missions we did.
So with that mission that you just referenced, did you have a particular, I know earlier you mentioned like why would this battle be occurring? You know, I think you said the name was Foothold. Is that right?
Right.
Right.
Foothold.
Yeah.
So did you have an initial inspiration for that you want, like a specific story you were trying to tell?
So if I'm remembering back now, when this mission was originally written, it was one of the team members that brought it forward. And it was literally supposed to be kind of, if the line here is being pushed by one side is desperately trying to hold on to that ground because this could represent a new redefining of battle lines if they fail,
right,
whereas the other side really wants that ground. So that's what this story was meant to be.
So, yeah. So, and just to make sure I'm understanding you right, it's like getting, you know, it's the foothold, right? So you have your battle lines and that this specific section, once a new foothold has been established, it's going to then shift, you know, kind of where everything else goes and what else is able to, it may be, you know, taking control over a supply depot, and that allows the,
or even a road.
Yeah. Or
I mean,
a road.
A
exactly.
Good example again is like, let's use Bakhmut that happened, you know, within the last few months. 'Cause that's very modern for people at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times, I mean, they were fighting street to street. Stalingrad is the exact same way.
Right.
You can use anywhere along the Western Front for World War One. Also, for reference in that, was that any little sector that was taken was a major point.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a quadrant, if you want to call it that, you know, in as far as foothold, you know, when we're looking at this mission. It's because these missions, you know, when you're looking like that's your sector, that's your AO, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's your area of operations. You need to go. You need to take that for whatever reason,
right?
And I find that fascinating how you guys go about that, because as opposed to, let's use, I mean, I'm not hating on the victory point system, mm-hmm. you know, or I should say on the, oh, point A, point B, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Right, your standard objective style game.
Yeah, I'm not hating on that right now, but I a lot of times I have problems with it, and the main reason as to why is because here is a random point, mm-hmm. and don't get me wrong, sometimes those random points could be, and I can come up with any sort of, I don't know.
Kind of like mental gymnastic justification.
I didn't want to go there, but yeah, I can go with some mental gymnastics as to why this particular point is interesting and why I'm willing to sacrifice X amount of my guys to take said point. Mm-hmm. However, I can only do that so many times.
Yes.
Where how Panoptica is looking at it and with the foothold mission, and we're only looking at one of how many?
12 standard missions.
We're only looking at one of 12,
right.
So mind you, okay? Is that in this mission, it's, hey, this whole point here, this whole AO mm-hmm. is important. This needs to be taken because our commanders, you know, Brass said, yo, this is important. This AO right here is important. We're tasking you with taking said AO, execute.
Yep.
Now, because of that, you know, and then when you break the map up into four different quadrants, it's like, how much of it can you actually take? It's not some objective.
Right.
The map itself is the objective, and that's what I really like about that. It really brings that sense of realism mm-hmm. to the tabletop. And if you're coming from that perspective, I would highly recommend the Panoptica system, because again, we're only looking at just one, and that, to at least from my very limited point of view, it makes a lot more sense from a more militaristic perspective, from a more realistic perspective. And mm-hmm. I love the way that Panoptica has gone about that business of, hey, how can we bring generic missions to life on the tabletop that feel like there's skin in the game?
Yeah, I think
absolutely.
Are you saying?
As well as the standard missions, which obviously there's all 12 of those in there. I mentioned earlier we've also got some Apocalypse missions and Zomatalis missions in there as well. And to dig into those, I think might be interesting.
Yeah.
Because you mentioned, obviously, a lot of people are feeling a bit bored or a bit played out. And obviously, I touched on that as well mm-hmm. With the standard missions. But I think that a lot of people are kind of used to Heresy being played at 3,000 points and might want to do something bigger, something, you know, with higher stakes.
Right.
And that was kind of the inspiration for the Apocalypse missions, because those are intended for 4,000 point minimum size games.
Right.
And then they bring in numerous primary objectives and numerous secondary objectives to increase the amount of things you've got to do to show that this is a much larger scale battle. There's a lot more going on, and that's the kind of the concept there.
Right. You have the standard missions, you have the Apocalypse missions, you have the Zomertalis missions. Without getting into the weeds of, you know, because we're not going to go over each individual one, mm-hmm. you know, in this podcast. I mean, these are free, by the way, if anyone's listening. You can get these on, you know, we're going to have them in the show notes, as you know, so you can get all these for free. The big thing that I want to ask is, when it comes to the mission set, how do you differentiate them between, let's say, standard, Zomertalis, and Apocalypse? And what are some similarities and differentiations between those three within those three sets of rules? And how do you make those unique as opposed to what's already available to us via GW?
So the standard missions are designed in a similar manner to the core rulebook missions, and accidentally ended up being quite similar to the Siege of Chthonia missions, because all of our standard Apocalypse and Zomertalis missions were written before Siege of Chthonia released by a couple of months, mm-hmm. and then we released them just after. So there was a surprising amount of overlap in that design space, which actually was quite interesting to see that we were on the right track as the standard GW designers, who do a fantastic job with the work they do. So the differentiation we've got is that the standard missions, they're all aimed at kind of a 6-foot by 4-foot board. They're all aimed at 3,000 point to 2,000 point size games. They are typically intended to be 5 to 6 turns long. That's kind of the design space for those missions. The Apocalypse missions, by contrast, are designed for 4,000 points and above. They're aimed at 8 foot by 6 foot tables or larger, with a scaling up commensurately of deployment zones to match that. They're also aimed more at 4 to 5 turns, so they're a little bit shorter because they match to 4 the table. And like I mentioned earlier, they have you doing more different objectives. So there's normally 2 primaries and then 3 to 5 secondaries. The aim there is that if a smaller game represents the one key point on a massive line, this could be 2 key zones that just so happen to be right next to each other during your gameplay.
That makes sense.
Finally, then the ZM missions are an expansion of the Zomatalis missions that we saw, obviously, in the White Dwarf issue that had the starter ZM rules in, that then was expanded upon in Siege of Chthonia. We did have to do a bit of an emergency rewrite on those because we'd obviously written them to match up with the White Dwarf missions, mm-hmm. or mission, should I say,
right.
that then was kind of upended with how things like reinforcements were handled. So those are probably likely to see a slight bit of polish up again in the future, as well as maybe some additional missions.
Right. And there's a little bit more, because of how Siege of Chthonia has changed how ZM games get played, can we theoretically see more from Panoptica as far as a continuation of that?
Yeah, I think so. In particular, the concept of Apex missions actually really excites me. Mm-hmm. Because it's an evolution, I would say, of the thematic missions we saw in the Black Books for Heresy 1.0.
Mm-hmm.
So the missions may be slightly imbalanced. They may be encouraging the defender or the attacker to have the advantage. They might skew terrain to one player's advantage or other mission special rules. There's a lot of stuff going on there that just subtly shifts how that game will play.
Right.
And it's aimed for a narrative experience over everything else. Where most of the missions are obviously aimed at balanced gameplay that can tell a narrative, the Apex missions, to my eye, lean to narrative first.
Right.
And I think that there's a lot of space there for us to do something with that and to do our own Apex missions in the future. And we may or may not be working on some at the moment. What shape those might take on what publication they might be in, I can't say. But they are coming as part of a future expansion.
Excellent.
I'm very, very excited about that. You heard it here first.
No, well, and I,
an exclusive, eh?
Yeah, there you go.
No, I really like what you said about how, I think you said it really well, just with the standardized missions, they're designed towards balanced gameplay that can fit the narrative, whereas those Apex missions, because, like, for those of us who played 1.0, the Apex missions were always, like, you know, like you said,
they weren't the Apex in 1.0. They were the narrative Black Book.
Yeah.
Just for clarification.
Yes. But they're very narrative focused, narrative, you know, first, right? And those are, like, at least for myself, and I might go on a limb here, and I may be the minority in that, as far as, like, the wider Heresy community that really enjoys sort of the off-balance mission. But I think those are really cool, particularly, like, looking at actual, you know, historical combat is, like, it's, you know, you don't,
no,
it's
mission,
not a balanced.
No operation that you go on is supposed to be balanced,
yes.
if done correctly. Sun Tzu said something very along those lines. It's like, listen, if you're fighting a fair fight, you're doing something wrong.
No, and I think it's really fun because, like, we always talk about getting into the theater of the mind of our commander. It's like, if we're gonna play a mission that, let's say, it's you know, kind of leaning in favor of the attacker, right? And me and my opponent were setting something up before, and we go, hey, we're gonna do this mission. You're the attacker. I'm the defender. I know that I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage, right? And for me, I enjoy that because I'm going, okay, how can I work out, like, how can I find the advantage, right? How can I, you know,
exploit it,
right? How can I get my opponent's heavy armor stuck in the mud and then my light infantry sweep them off the ground, just like the, you know, the Battle of Agincourt, right?
How can
I find that and exploit it and look for that level of nuance? And I think that's really fun. And, like, you know, I think it's the test of like a true commander as well. And it's really, and so I would, you know, like what you were saying earlier, Dan, like I am super pumped for you guys. If that's something that's coming down the pipeline, I'm definitely going to be using some of those.
Absolutely. You already know it. And I also know, Ollie, that you were also talking about the Apocalypse missions. Can you speak a little bit to that as well?
Yeah, sure. So the Apocalypse missions, with them having multiple primary objectives and slightly shorter game lengths, it's going to encourage you to be a bit more aggressive with your gameplay. One of the first things that I kind of remember thinking when we were looking at how we would do those larger scale missions is, well, if it's a 6-turn game with 5,000 points on the table, every turn is going to be an absolute slog. Nobody wants to just sit there going, cool, okay, I've got 6 line units, I don't have to worry about capturing objectives just yet. That's not engaging. It doesn't mm-hmm. encourage anybody to actually get involved and play the game.
Right.
It just encourages people to sit back. And so, shorter game length, you've got less time to capture those objectives, and there's more to do, so get on it.
Right.
And that's kind of the game design aspect that we went for with those.
Well, I think particularly like mentioning that, hey, we're going to have the game be designed shorter, mm-hmm. right? It shows that there's that level of intentionality behind it, where it's like, hey, we want this to be a positive experience, you know, like you said, like lighting the fire under your butt to get out and go get stuff. And like, even, and that just makes sense. Like one of the things I immediately think of is like, when you see Apocalypse games, like you were saying earlier, the first couple turns are typically everything staying back and shooting, right? Mm-hmm. Which, just like thinking from like a realistic perspective, if we had an Apocalypse battle, like, right now, you wouldn't have all of your artillery drive up to like close range and then just sit there and shoot from the back, you know, the back of that close range engagement, right? If they're moving in, they're moving in with purpose to engage.
Right.
And so you want that, like your Reaver Titans, your Warlord Titans, all those big things as they're moving in, like the start of the game is, I mean, they've been shooting at each other for the past, like, you know, 4, 5, 6 turns prior to that point of the game actually starting.
Right.
And so it's really like, it's rushing it in and it's showing, hey, this is this, you know, 10 to 15 minutes of critical fighting that's going to occur. And I think that's really cool.
So, Ollie, how do you facilitate that? If you can give us a little teaser, how do you facilitate, you know, lighting that fire under the player's butt?
Yeah, so obviously I've already talked about the shorter games and the extra objectives to kind of encourage people to go out there and score the VPs. But the other thing I think typically is we've encouraged bigger table sizes, which actually means that playing, I don't know about you, if you've put 3,000 points on a table, you can fill your deployment zone quite comfortably. It's easier with some armies, militia, than others. But even with Space Marines, it's very easy to do.
Yes.
Even Custodes, you can fill out your deployment zone because you've got a lot of, you know, big grav tanks and stuff going on, mm-hmm. and then everything's on 40mm bases. You can fill your DZ. So by changing it up and saying, yeah, we recommend an 8-foot by 6-foot table, oh, and your DZ scales with that, so it gets bigger. That in itself is going to make it so that you've got to space your units out. You need to choose where you put things. But you've got more space to put a bigger army in the first place. Mm-hmm. So playing a bigger game doesn't feel like a chore of, can I even deploy everything? Can I even be bothered?
Right.
Because now there is the space to actually build your army out. And an engagement of that size, if you had your artillery battery, they can afford to hang back a bit. If you've got your close assault units, they'll be right at the front of your deployment zone. Mm-hmm. There's actually going to be some spacing and some layering. So there's tactical elements to that. And I think that encourages players to really get involved as well.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And I love what y'all are doing with that. And again, if you all want to see what he's talking about, all these documents are for free. Again, and they're split up in each respective form. Now, one thing I want to talk about before we get too long in the tooth mm-hmm. is the Crusade system. So, Ollie, why don't you explain the Crusade system for 30K, how that was developed, and why did you think that was a necessity for 30K?
So Crusade kind of started as a bit of a love letter from a couple of the team members to 9th edition's Crusade system, which is, you know, quite well beloved. But also it kind of has a lot of little harkenings back to older versions of the game, as well as some of like the more narrative elements from expansions like Planet Strike and Cities of Death. You know, the little tiny callbacks in there to those things. To me, standalone games are great fun, and I love them. But some people really want to do those linked narratives of, well, this thing happens, so my units get a bit better. And then because of that, the next time they fight, they've got that experience, that skill, they've built that up. They're not going to be the same force that they were at the start. Even if they're resupplied, they're going to have learned, and they're going to be better, or they're going to have suffered, and they're going to be worse off for that.
Right.
So Crusade, from its outset, when I was talking to, you know, the team members who were taking the real spearhead and writing it, they wanted to show that. There's also been, you know, little elements of rebalancing, so it's not just a pickup of 9th edition's Crusade, it's a full rewrite. But to us, it was necessary to allow evolving gameplay. And if you've got a small group of 5 or 6 people who only play against each other, and you want to show that campaign on, you know, your planet, your system, mm-hmm. as it changes and evolves, this is the way to do it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And one thing is, I like how you said it's not just a reskin of the 40K version of it, right? There is a lot more skin in the game. There's a lot more intentionality to what you guys developed and how it's specific to the Horus Heresy universe. Can you give us a teaser as to how that manifests throughout a campaign?
Yes, certainly. So some of the relics in the relic tables that we've designed actually harken back to 1.0 and some of the campaign books, the black books. Some of them specifically actually will be quite familiar to people who played those. There's also lots of little nods to older versions of 40K that will be, again, familiar to older players and veterans. But everything is built out in such a way that it feels natural to slot it into Heresy. So an example of what I was talking about there would be the Phasewalker relic, which anybody who remembers kind of the old black books will know that.
Yes.
It allows you to redeploy as though, you know, you're walking straight through terrain, you're out of phase mm-hmm. with the material universe, and off you go. Whereas some of them, like the Cloaking Field or the Aegis Invictus, will actually make your character a little bit harder to get a hold of, a little bit harder to damage. So rewarding you for playing strategically or picking that relic, that's what we're all about.
So our local group is about to be doing a crusade using the Panoptica rule set. And so kind of in preparation of that, and this was a couple weeks ago, I remember going through the like the veterancy skills and basically what your squads can pick up as they, you know, achieve their accolades, as they get more experience. And I really like the level of like of how you guys balance the experience aspect. It's not like you win a battle and then, okay, cool, all your squads are just better now. It's like they have to actually do things and be involved in the fight and be successful. And I think that really adds a level, and I'm really curious for how our experience is with it, right? But I think there's going to be times where people are like, well, hey, you know, do I want to commit my, you know, my veteran unit in on this objective? Do I want to do this? Do I want to, you know, like, do I want to engage the enemy there? Because in a pickup game, you can kind of just be like, oh yeah, you know, my like, you know, I play the Night Lord, so I'll use them. It's like, okay, well, my Terror Marines, they're probably going to kill that tactical squad, and, you know, sure, they're going to get opened up to get, you know, shot at next turn by those, that group of predators around the corner. But like, if I can kill their scoring squad, you know, it's beneficial for me, right? And it really, like, that's kind of the standard, like, Warhammer kind of mindset to stuff, if that
right,
makes
because
sense.
Everything exists within a vacuum.
Exactly.
In a pickup game. And I'm not trashing on pickup games. Excuse me. I'm not trashing on them.
It's just that's the reality of it.
Yeah, exactly. Because, you know, that unit's going to be there next turn.
Yes.
You know, not next turn. It's going to be their next game.
Yes.
That you play.
Well, so the veterans see, it's like, okay, if I have my squad that, you know, they've gained X special rule, right? As a result of them, like, I know you had one veterancy thing that gave scout, right? And so, you know, with the Terror Marines, they have infiltrate. And I'm like, okay, this is really cool. If I can use infiltrate and if I can keep them alive their first couple games to get scout, then I can infiltrate and scout, right? And so now that opens up, like, you know, that's the type of shenanigans that I like to do. So it's like, I don't even know if it's going to be good, right? But it's just cool.
It doesn't matter. It's cool, man. Who cares so if,
like,
it's good?
Yeah, so I'm like, I really want to get this, like, special ability, right? Mm-hmm. And so that way I can infiltrate and then I can scout, because that's, you know, that's how I want to play this army. That's what I want to use, right? And so now I, when I'm going to play my first game, I'm going to be thinking about that actual, like how I utilize that unit differently. Right. And I'm going to have, you know, that more level of nuance, that more, that higher level of intentionality, have a little bit more thoughtfulness and have more of like a connection to what actually happens in the games, because I have the consequences of that to deal with at the end of the game with the bookkeeping.
Right. Exactly. And so a question I have for you, Ollie, is how is that implemented? So let's say we're going to use Josh's example. He's got his Night Lords and he has a sense of intentionality in regards to a particular unit and what he wants to upgrade them with. How does that manifest as far as Panoptica is concerned?
So typically, wherever, let's say you mentioned you've got your unit that you want to get scout on. You go through the game, you keep them alive. At the end of the game, you have earned enough experience points to pick a battle trait. You could go in directly and pick that battle trait to say, I think this is pretty thematic. Or you can roll randomly if you'd prefer. Generally speaking, then you'd note that down on your Crusade card. So that minimizes that bookkeeping aspect because you've got a printed out card and we've provided one that people can just print out and use straight away. We've tried to minimize any kind of overheads for people having to make their own. So that intentionality of you've done the thing, you've earned the reward you want to get, you've now got the reward. That is in and of itself designed to be a bit more engaging, where you've played them the right way that you want to show you can now tell that story by upgrading them in that way to show that they've earned that upgrade.
Yeah, and then I also really like with kind of the inverse side of that, where on one hand you have benefits, right? But then on the other hand, you have your units that, like, you know, again, just using my army as an example, when I run tactical marines, when I run assault marines, particularly my assault marines, I really don't care what happens to them. I just kind of send them forward, right? And so I'm curious.
You don't care about random tactical marines?
Yeah,
well,
no, because you know, my praetor, he's just going to be like, oh, you guys are the new recruits, just send them in. You know, whoever makes it out, props to you. But the rest of you, you're just kind of cannon fodder, right?
Right.
And so telling kind of the inverse of that, where it's like, I'm going to have my squads that get beaten down time and time again, and they're going to have negatives, right? And so as a result of those negatives, I then have to, it's kind of like what we were talking about earlier, like how do you, you know, after you have a debuff, right? Or a, you know, a nerf, like kind of a campaign applied nerf to your unit, like how do you still get them to be useful, right? How, and then for myself, like, I think of it from the perspective, again, of just using the Assault Marines as an example. Like, if I'm sending them in and they're always going in and just getting blown off the table every single game, right? Because it's typically what happens. But as a result, like, how does that kind of in-universe shake the psyche of that squad sergeant, right? How does he then perceive the world around him differently, right? And those are going to be, you know, applied via those various nerfs. And then as a result, I get to come up with the story and the character and the kind of the explanation behind the scenes for what's going on. Like, if you're someone who enjoys writing battle reports or kind of keeping track of that element within the narrative of your guys, like, that's, in my opinion, maybe an even better opportunity, because you are then having to go in and justify, like, maybe that Assault Marine squad, they get hit with like a -1 leadership penalty, right? As one of those nerfs, where they're just permanently -1 leadership. Why is that, you know, that leadership nerf applied, right? How is that sergeant, you know, who is he? How is his character different? What happened to him to cause that change in personality, that change in status, that change in command power, right? You know, what occurred? And so that's what's, I think, is really cool. And like, kind of to what I was saying at the beginning of this little spiel, like, if you're, you know, someone who writes battle reports, like, how can you then go in and put that within the battle report and bring that to life, right? When you go and you're playing your next game, how is it that, you know, how can you explain that to your opponent to make them get drawn in and more immersed in the battle? You know, how can you kind of, you know, bring that to life on the tabletop?
Yeah, to your point, there was a battle called the Battle of Gallipoli, okay? And it was between the British Empire and the Ottoman Empire, and there's a lot of other factions involved. The Australians played a massive role in that battle. So one thing that's very interesting about that is that you start to see especially because that battle was so well documented, you start to see how some of their commanding officers, mm-hmm. when they were sending their on both sides, on the Ottoman side as well as the British Australian side, mm-hmm. troopers were dealing with it, mm-hmm. right? And the negative consequences of dealing with mass loss on that level, mm-hmm. right? How, hey, I already know I'm gonna get my boys, my whole platoon, my company, my regiment, whatever it is, right? I'm gonna chuck them at the enemy lines. I already know they're gonna die. They're mm-hmm. not gonna last, right? And I think that plays a role into your commander, mm-hmm. because, you know, that's just Gallipoli. I don't want to say just. I mean, I don't want to, you know, detract from what, you know, the conflict and what happened about 100 years ago. But when you look at it from the heresy scale, mm-hmm. right, from millions and billions of human beings that are being chucked as chaff, mm-hmm. right? How does that look like, you know, and what effect does that have on the commanders on right. the battlefield? What does that have on, let's say, the survivors? Mm-hmm. So we're going to look at your Night Lords again. What is that? What effect does that have on that sergeant mm-hmm. of that squad or your company commander, your centurion, when he just chucks all these boys? Oh, well, you know, they're assault squad. Screw them. They're going to go and they're going to die.
Right.
Right. Is he some guy who has... you know, who doesn't truly care, and, mm-hmm. and how will that affect how he operates, right? Yeah. Or will it be someone who actually does care?
Mm-hmm.
And how does that affect his perspective when his boys get absolutely massacred?
Mm-hmm.
And the cool thing, getting back to Panoptica, is Panoptica expands mm-hmm. on those storytelling potential.
Right.
And I really, really like that with what Ollie, what your team has done with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And kind of the whole point of it is supposed to be that, yes, it is punishing to throw units away. No sensible commander would just expend lives for the sake of it unless they had no other choice.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Of course, some commanders
or they're psycho.
That's fine. But they're nuts. Yeah, exactly. They're on one. Whereas if you absolutely had to throw that unit away and, you know, a handful of those survivors come trudging back into, you know, the command post at the end of it and say, yeah, we survived that barely, you would expect them to be coming back with, you know, traits being shaken up and, you know, whatever's happened to them, there may be an element of, you know, survivor's guilt perhaps or something like that.
And how would that look like?
Having a way to actually, exactly, to translate mm-hmm. that from this kind of nebulous concept of, would they be okay to, no, probably not, and this is how this would have actually impacted them. That's kind of what we were aiming for with that.
And that's what I love. It's bringing that sense of realism mm-hmm. to the tabletop. And so to round out this section is, as far as Panoptica goes, right, I know that there were some changes that were made as far as reformatting Panoptica and how that would look like as far as, you know, it went from its original state to what it is now. Why did you make those changes as far as, okay, hey, this is the original section of how Panoptica in its original form is to what it looks like now and the reformatting that went with that? Why did you do that? What was the decision-making as far as that goes?
So we've had a lot of feedback in the past from different groups saying it's hard to pick apart, what is this thing? Why is this thing being changed? Or where do I find this? And so in the past, as you know, people who've looked at the documents before will know, we color-coded things with little gem icons to show, you know, FAQ, errata, balance change. And that was a good step for us, but it was, in my opinion, not as far as we could have gone. So with version 4, we've actually released some cut-down versions, which take out the game modes, the missions, everything else, put them aside and say, they're for the people who really want them. They can absolutely download the main book. But if you just want to pick up a cut-down version that has the changes for you and nothing else, pick that 25-page document up that's a cut-down version, and you're straight away with it. You can start playing. I think that there's a lot of people out there who might say, well, that's still a lot of content. That's too much for me to remember.
Right.
To that, I might say, I don't think that anybody could ever truthfully say they know every stat line, every special rule, every piece of war gear, every weapon of the units that they have in their, you know, 3,000-point list that they use every day, if they're playing Heresy every day. You know, being hyperbolic.
I mean, if they're so fortunate to play a game every day.
That would be nice, wouldn't it?
Right.
But as a result, I would say that realistically, if you're going to bring Panoptica into your local play group, or even just play a game with it, the only things you need to know is the kind of two double page spreads of core rules amendments we've made. That's it. Everything else, you can go through your army list and note down. For example, I don't know, you're playing Mechanicum. Castellax shock charges have been changed. Mm-hmm. That's it. And then you go to the weapon section. It's right there. You don't need to remember the profile. You can just go find it. If you are playing Marines and you're using, I don't know, a flyer, you'll go, oh, I've got a countermeasure save because that's a core rules amendment. So flyers, countermeasure save. Mm-hmm. And then you know to go check that. So it might seem daunting on the face of it, but those cut down versions really help make that process a lot easier. And typically, all you really need to know are the amendments to your things. And even then, just knowing to go check them is usually enough.
Yeah.
Right. And then letting your opponent know, obviously, hey, you know what? This does this instead of, or whatever exactly. The case may be. I like how you're making it easier to navigate, you know? So, you know, one big question that comes up is, oh, well, there's all these documents. How do I tackle this? Right. You're understanding that concept of, okay, hey, we understand there's a lot of content out there. How can we make it easier for the end user to navigate? And then even more so than that, how can it be easily implemented within a game system so it doesn't obstruct the gameplay?
Right. And I think one of the other things you mentioned is, like, you really only need to, like, you said, like, you need to know the things that affect you, right? But, like, I mean, even with myself, like, I've just printed out the pages, I mean, which is only, like, 5 or 6 pages that specifically affect me. And so I have a little binder that I keep in my, you know, model carrying case and whatnot. But the binder is basically the first 5, 6 pages are the specific changes that, like, I know with my army, these are the things that I need to remember, right? Like, the direct changes that impact me. And I don't even necessarily remember what they are. Like, I just know, hey, when X comes up, I need to go check my binder, right? And so then I go, okay, cool, X came up. Hey, there's something that I need to go check real quick. Let me go see what this is, right? Then I, you know, flip it open. Okay, cool. Hey, you know, here's the change that's different. This is what I, you know, needed to remember, right? And then, and like, I also have the Decurion and the Praetorian modes and some other stuff, like, you know, printed out in there as well. But like, it's really not that much when you look at your specific army, right? And like, and you would be, like, at least in my opinion, I think it'd be a little crazy to try and, like, be responsible for what your opponent's changes are as well.
Right.
Right. Like, that would be a little much. I don't think that would be a fair expectation to have on yourself.
Well, I think it's also your responsibility as the opponent to say, hey, I play Sons of Horus. So let's say we're playing a game.
Yes.
I'm playing my Sons of Horus. You're playing Air Night Lords. We're fighting each other for whatever reason. Right.
Right.
Bringing that up at the beginning of the game, saying, hey, these are the changes.
Yes.
Or this, you know, that are made, or hey, these Panoptica changes and or Centura changes are being made. Right. I want you to be aware of those. So there's no haha gotcha moments.
Exactly. Exactly.
And vice versa as well.
And because each faction really isn't modified that much, it ends up not being that much overall content. Like you were saying, Walrus, like, you need to have the core rules, right? And so, you know, I have those printed out. And I show my opponent, like, hey, here's the core rules changes in Panoptica. I just wanted to make sure, you know, everything's good to go on that front. And then, like, here's my, and then, like, I'll flip the page and I have, like with the Night Lord stuff, right? Because you kind of have it, you know, with the Legion, like the Legiones Traitorous, right? Like, portion, it's like each faction is kind of grouped up together. So I'm like, hey, from here where it says Night Lords to here where it starts the next Legion, these are the things that change. But really, this one thing is the only thing that's affecting my army today. So I just wanted to show you that and make you aware of it at the beginning.
And I like how you said that was not changed that much. And I like how the Panoptica team was very intentional about that. And Ollie, if you can explain a little bit more on that, was, it's not like where these changes are, oh, well, this unit used to work with this way, but now it works in a 180 degree turn and now it works completely different. I like how the Panoptica team was intentional about making those changes and making them fit seamlessly into the core rule set that is available via GW.
Yeah. So, generally speaking, the design mentality, the ethos that we go in with is, what is this unit supposed to do? So, Games Workshop's written a lore blurb that says, this unit is great at this thing. Okay, the rules don't allow them to do that. Like, the rules are letting them down. And the concept is cool, but it just doesn't reach that point. Okay, if we tweak this thing, we turn this up, we turn this down, we move this around a little bit, it retains its core identity, and maybe actually leads into it better than it did before, but we've not upended the unit and had to rewrite everything from scratch. Mm-hmm. Does that feel right? And generally speaking, whenever we change something, we try and retain at least the original intent from GW as much as we can understand it, which we're not the original writers, so maybe we get things wrong, and we always hold our hands up when we do that. We take all the feedback that we get, and we mm-hmm. do look at all of it, but if we can just push certain things to say, this should do this, and it doesn't, so let's make it do that, that's the intention every time. And I think that would be, it would be wrong for us to not do that. If we looked at a unit, for example, and went, well, I think it should do this, and it doesn't do that, so let's just rewrite it from the ground up, it misses the mark, because that's not what the intention was.
Yeah, that's out of line with what you guys' goals are.
Right, and the humility there to understand that and to bring it in with what GW's already produced in order to build a cohesive community, in my opinion, is really the core of what Panoptica is all about.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of time the question we get asked is, why are you changing this? Mm-hmm. And the honest answer is because we want the game to be as engaging as it can be for everybody.
Right.
There shouldn't be any units that stay on the shelf just because they're bad.
Yes.
Right.
You know, it's all well and good to go. Well,
it's stealing from the story, you know, because, I mean, there's a unit that, I mean, if GW or Forge World made a unit, right, or Alan Blythe made a unit, it shouldn't just stay on the shelf because, oh, it's not good. It should help tell said story.
Right. And it should have some, like, again, these are the, I guess looking at it from maybe like an in-universe perspective, this is the pinnacle of human fighting capability, right? These are the Space Marines. And so while, like, you know, like one choice might not be the meta choice, you guys are going in and going, hey, how can we boost that to not make it an overpowered choice?
Well, also not overriding GW,
but either. What is the purpose of it in the story? That, right, because again, the Space Marines are the pinnacle of human fighting capability. So if they are using it, then like it must serve some purpose.
Yeah, what is that purpose, and how can it be properly applied on the tabletop?
One thing as well, just like for those who might feel that getting into Panoptica, kind of as you were saying earlier, like, maybe a little daunting. How have you guys designed the separation between the documents to sort of ease that for maybe a new person looking at getting into it?
So those separate documents that I mentioned earlier, there's actually four cut down versions. So the four are for Astartes, so specifically Loyalists, Heretics, Mechanicum, and Imperium factions. Each one contains kind of our allies matrix changes, as well as the core rules changes and Siege of Chthonia changes that we put in. And then they will contain typically the relevant Libra. So in the Astartes variant, for example, it's Libra Astartes and Hereticus common changes that affect both books. And then the Libra Astartes specific items. There's also the legacies and exemplary battles items, the special rules section, and the weapons section. That itself then means that you have everything that affects Astartes in that one position.
Reload on your latest Games Workshop and hobby supplies at Hangar 18 Hobbies. We have a massive selection of Gunpla, RC cars, model rocketry, and RC planes like the P-40 Warhawk and the P-51 Mustang. Not to mention a wall dedicated to the Horus Heresy alone, as well as 40K and other Games Workshop games. Want something 3D printed? Hangar 18 offers print per order 8K printing for all your 3D printed projects. Into historicals and other game systems as well, Hangar 18 offers a large selection of board games such as Battletech, Black Powder Red Earth, and A Song of Ice and Fire. Check out Hangar 18 Hobbies at hangar18hobbies.com and see why this is the hobby hub of choice for the Iteratus Podcast.
All right, and so part two of this episode is we're going to talk about Ingenium. So, Walrus, why don't you explain what Ingenium is and why that's important to bring to 30K?
Cool, okay. So, there's a lot of conversations I hear had around a book that Forge World was supposed to be working on a long time ago called Fires of Syraxis. For those who don't know, Fires of Syraxis was intended to bring all of the 30k model line into 40k. Unfortunately, with the change of editions and obviously the very sad passing of Alan Bly, the book never came to fruition, wasn't ever released. But the concept of what it was, to take all the things from the Mechanicum in one setting and bring them across, stuck with me. And when I then got more and more into Heresy and kind of started to drift away from playing 40k, I had quite a big Mechanicum army that had basically started to have to just languish on a shelf. And then I was reading the 1.0 Mechanicum book, and there's some little mentions of Skitarii in there and them being, you know, part of the larger Targmata war engine. And so my brain went back to Fires of Syraxis and said, well, if Forge World were going to go in one direction, what is stopping me from going back the other way?
Right.
So I sat down and I wrote out, at the time, a book that was called The Marching Forge, which did exactly that. And you learn a lot through, you know, your initial explorations of rules writing. It was the first proper large-scale project I'd done that wasn't just a one-pager. But that was the initial version for Heresy 1.0. Ingenium represents the evolution of that concept to Heresy 2.0. So it's all of the plastic kits you can get for Mechanicum in 40k brought to 30k, with some tweaks to make them fit in better or alternative weapon options and so on. But also it brings in some things that are missing from Mechanicum in 2.0. So that's maybe units or options that have been left behind, as well as some characters and some unique ideas that just really fit in with how I think the Mechanicum should be presented.
Right. And one thing I like about this is that one big thing about Mechanicum with 30K is that a large part of the range is Forge World supported. And so a lot of times I'll get someone who plays 30K or who's, let's say, plays 40K and wants to get into 30K, and they go, well, I have all these models and I want to bring them. Can I play them in 40K? Now, with the base rule set of Liber Mechanicum, I have to, you know, there's that tough conversation that you have to have, which is,
it's like, you kind of got to get a whole new army, bro.
Yeah, that's a tough sell, especially for a lot of these guys, because, you know, you'll have somebody that'll come in and be like, yeah, but these models, I put on my heart and soul into them, I painted them, they look really cool, and you're saying I can't play with them? And then they go into the Black Library and they're like, wait a minute, this Skitarii guy is running around shooting, and, you know, there's this character who is a Skitarii, let's use that, right?
Yeah.
Why can't I play him in 30K? Why isn't there rules for that model in a larger extent for that unit within the 30K universe?
Yeah.
It limits you telling your story. So with Panoptica, with Liber Ingenium, it allows you to get that plastic range that you would normally have within AdMech, within 40K, and port that over into 30K without it breaking the lore.
I think the best example I can give is actually the Sidonian Dragoons and the Iron Strider Ballistarius, which both use at their core something called the Iron Strider engine. In the 40K codexes, both 7th and 8th, as well as a little bit the 9th lore, there is mentions that it was something that was perfected in M33. So perfected implies that maybe it existed before that, but in and of itself, it's not the best that it's in, and it gets better by the time of 40k. So it's a very rare case of some of the lore kind of saying that maybe this thing only came into existence later or was made better by that point.
Right.
So when we were writing those units, as an example, we gave them a rule to kind of represent that prototype construct that gives you some bonuses that they just have by default in 40k, but with a small downside. So that's kind of the way that we leaned on that. The other thing we do, for example, if we're going to look at the the Cataphron Breachers and Cataphron Destructor servitors, they get more weapon options in Heresy to represent the fact that right now they're just a gun platform to the Mechanicum.
Right.
So they would just slap whatever they had lying around at the time, which means that some of their 40k options, the grav weapons in particular come to mind, and the torsion, you know, weapons and stuff, they're not around right now. They don't have those, but they do have the regular grav weapons, so that's what they're using on them instead.
Huh.
I think one thing, if I may just add to what you're saying, like from my own perspective, a lot of the Heresy lore is written, like, it is distinctly stated that this is an incomplete and may not always be accurate recollection, right?
Right.
And so, like, this is where, like, I find these type of things kind of cool. So, you have the Imperium of Man, which believes in the Imperial Truth, and from kind of like a bureaucratic or like kind of in-universe perspective, the kind of the powers of Mars, for lack of a better term, right, represent a very distinct threat and ideological difference to the Imperial Truth. Right.
Right.
And so if I'm an iterator, or if I'm, say, you know, a remembrancer.
You are an iterator. Yeah,
but like if I'm an in-universe like remembrancer and someone who's recording this, right, I will have gone through extensive education and maybe a certain level of indoctrination that will show that something like a Cataphron Destructor is not like, it's just made up. It doesn't actually exist, right? Hey, you know, and I will have gone through and experienced these things based on the powers that be within the Imperial Truth to say, hey, no, this is not real, right? So if you hear something about it, just disregard it. It's just, you know, whispers in the wind, right?
Almost kind of like to, what's the word I'm looking for? To like, kind of like, eh.
Yeah, just kind of shake that off, right? It doesn't, you know, it's just some crazy people talking about some crazy things, you
right.
know, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of my thought with the Mechanicum has been, it's not that these things didn't exist, but it's just that it, for
propaganda purposes.
Yeah, for the side of the Imperial Truth to stand firm, right, these things can't exist. So by necessity of ideology, they don't exist.
Right.
And so things like the with what you said, I love that that's an in-universe example. Like, these were perfected by M33, right?
Right.
The Mechanicum make esoteric and incredibly, esoteric and very advanced technology, and they were doing that like probably before the Emperor even started going out conquering the galaxy, right?
Right.
So there's all these various schematics and you know, weapons and technology that they have access to that are going to exist, but due to the nature of like the necessity of the Imperial Truth to stand firm and be unquestioned, it's like these things aren't going to get the light isn't going to get shine on shined on those,
especially things. Something as grave as
like how a Cataphron Destroyer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and bringing that back to Panoptica,
mm-hmm.
when you're dealing with a when you're dealing with these models, right, when you're dealing with, you know, having these models on the tabletop and saying, hey, I want to bring these, you know, to 30K, and having that difficult discussion with someone saying, hey, well, you know, I know they technically existed, but they're not in the rules. Enter in Ingenium and say, no, now you can have those. Mm-hmm. Now, and we can have a discussion on why they weren't there initially.
Right.
And it's not as a reason as to,
they didn't exist.
It was, exactly. It was just more of a, we just didn't want to talk about that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the penal battalions, right? Mm-hmm. You go and like, I don't know, let's look at, you used an example in one of our previous podcasts.
Okay.
About the German, what was it, wolf, werewolf, whatever it was.
Yeah, the werewolf program. Yep.
The werewolf.
Yep.
No one knows about the werewolf. Or mm-hmm. not no one, I'm not going to say that. Very few people know about the werewolf program,
mm-hmm.
right? But, and for those who didn't listen to one of our previous episodes on in regards to, it was a militia episode, explain a little bit about that, and also explain how that wasn't something that was that not many people might have known about, and well, why it might have gone under the radar in history.
Right, right. So everyone, well, I won't say everyone, but a lot of people know about the French resistance, right, during World War II, right? Essentially, it was the same concept, but from the German perspective. So as the Germans realized they were losing the war and their core territories were being invaded by the Allies and the Russians, right? I believe it was primarily under the leadership of Rudolf Hess, mm-hmm. but I'm not 100% on that. But I think it was mostly under Rudolf Hess. He basically began instructing German citizens, right, to form their own resistance, and you know, for the most part, it was highly unsuccessful, right? By the average German population was pretty much done with everything that was going on by the time that the Allies got to that point, right? But there were some that still fought back in various ways that they, you know, were kind of instructed to, right? And so, but today it's something that we're not talking, you know, that isn't really talked about, right? And
right.
I think maybe another example of something that was kind of disregarded because it wasn't beneficial to the ideology of the time is when the Russians initially reported the Holocaust occurring, right?
Right.
The entire Allies for, I don't remember exactly how long, but it was longer than 6 months. And my estimation is about it, or my kind of general remembrance is about a year.
Mm-hmm.
They said, hey, no, this is not going on. This is false information.
Who was saying
from
that?
Russia.
The Allies were getting that from the Russians.
Yes,
because
the
okay.
Allies were moving through Poland and mm-hmm. through the Slavic region prior to the British, Americans,
right, and
French.
Most of the concentration camps were located on that Polish on the Eastern Front.
Exactly. Yep. And so as the Russians were going through, they were sending the Russian command was saying, hey, we're discovering these atrocities. These things are going on. And for an extended period of time, the entire, like, particularly I don't know so much about like how it was handled in Britain, but I know in America it was, hey, no, this is false information. This is not true. This is lies that the Russians are spreading. And so, and that happened for an extended period of time because it wasn't beneficial. Now the command within the Americans, the high command, the important staff knew that it was real.
Right.
But the newspapers and the general, kind of the iterators and remembrancers of that time,
yeah,
right?
Uh-huh.
They would have gone, oh no, this isn't, you know, that's
it wasn't beneficial for their cause at that time frame.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. And so it was very much like there's multiple sources that when the news kind of broke, when American brigades started reaching that area and it was determined that information was true, it was kind of it was a much larger shock to the American people because they were like, hey, this is stuff for the last year that we were told was false.
Right.
And so, I think that's a really good example of kind of, you know, getting back to Ingenium. It's like these, you know, the incomplete, like, again, within universe, the incomplete,
like the cataphrons,
inaccurate,
the cataphrons, is that what they're called?
Yeah, cataphron breachers.
Right. And you're starting to see these, like, the heinous practices, if you mm-hmm. want to call it that, of what the Mechanicum are willing to go to
or
in order to
maybe even, like, again, another just theater of the mind thing, maybe cataphron breachers started as a traitor Mechanicum or you know, loyal to Mars, right? Because Mars
right.
betrayed
the
Emperor,
the true loyalist,
that
right?
confusing, like, dilemma you get in. But
right.
you know, traitorous to the Emperor, right? That side, maybe they're the ones that started the cataphron breachers, and then the loyal to the Emperor Mechanicum, you know, stumbled
through
upon
pragmatism.
Yes, exactly. Stumbled upon those mm-hmm. schematics and said, hey, we're going to start implementing this as well. And maybe that's why they exist in 40K.
Right. Because, I mean, if you look at cataphron destroyers, right, they're very, I mean, that isn't a nice life.
Oh,
to
it
have.
Is definitely
no.
heretical.
that is a very sad end
yeah.
To a human.
Yeah.
And again, that's not something that shouldn't be highly praised, right?
No.
But again, it's looking at the desperatism of the 30K universe.
Mm-hmm.
But more so than that, it also speaks to where humanity's willing to go
mm-hmm.
to in order to fulfill their military objectives.
Right.
And that's what 30K brings to light. Mm-hmm. And again, Ollie, what you were talking about earlier was, you know, it was perfected in the year. What year?
M33.
So yeah, so it was, it was perfected in M33, as now everyone knows about it, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone knows about the penal battalions. Everyone knows about, you know, the death squads. Everyone mm-hmm. knows about, you know, the Cataphron destroyers. Oh yeah, you know, now that everyone knows about it,
yep.
right? And it's not this shocking news.
Yep.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, it's perfected in a later date,
yeah.
right? It's kind of glossing over the atrocities that were that both sides committed during the heresy.
Yeah. I'm and just really quick here, Ollie, I'd love to hear your thoughts on kind of this in-universe sort of, you know, ideological justification for it. I don't know if it's something, you know, you've thought about before, but, you know, what are your thoughts?
So, to my mind, the Mechanicum would have often viewed a lot of the stuff they did as just means to an end. So, mm-hmm. look at the Tech Thralls, the Thalax. A lot of the units have some really horrific lore behind them when you actually dig into it. There's a little bit in one of the Heresy books themselves that talks about a librarian, you know, obviously psychically powered, walking near Thalax and describing all he can hear is screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's mm-hmm. like, all they've done is just turn the volume down. They don't want to hear it.
Yeah.
So they're just ignoring what they've done to human beings,
right?
Because it doesn't suit their narrative of, well, it was necessary to win the battles that we're fighting. The Great Crusade was hell, and we've done what we have to. The Mechanicum, just like the rest of the Imperial War Machine, are not the good guys. They never right. were, not even before the Heresy.
See, that's my argument,
and I think
right?
that's a it's a big misconception. Yeah. There were not any good guys. This was a campaign of genocide, and whether that was, you know, humans that wouldn't gladly be accepted into the fold, or whether it was Xenos.
You would not gladly
no
bend the
faction.
Knee.
You don't bend the knee exactly. to the Emperor. You know, you had it coming.
Get purged, boy. Yep.
Exterminatus, let's go.
Yeah. Every faction, though, has blood on their hands. Mm-hmm. Every single
right.
one of them. So you look at the Mechanicum and you think, oh, Cataphron destroyers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a person. It was a person. And look what they've done to them.
Right.
So there is a level of horror, almost. And body horror, actually, in Mechanicum is actually a thing that I don't think is talked about enough. There's a lot of that, and it is a big part of their faction identity.
Right, right, exactly. A good example of that would be in the novel Master of Mankind. The Mechanicum played a big role in that. And there was a scene that really stuck out to me was there was one of the members of the Mechanicum. He was going through and he saw a couple of dead, I believe they're Cataphron destroyers. It could have been something else. I'm not too quite sure what they were. But he goes in and he checks their data logs, right? Their mental data logs. And to see, like, oh, why did they die? They were here on this, they're pulling security detail. Why? You know, and now they're
dead. What happened?
Well, yeah, he's yeah. just trying to figure out what happened. And he plugs into one of them, and one of them is the sentry being a mother, right? Having their baby stripped from them, taken from them, and she's screaming, asking for their baby and whatnot and everything like that. And he's just like, oh, random memory, you know.
Like XX235,
yeah.
like delete.
Random memory that means nothing. Oh, yeah. Whatever. That's irrelevant to what I want. And mm-hmm. he just literally glosses over that to get to the point of how this, you know, how it died,
yeah.
right? How she died, I should say. And I think that shows the level of atrocities, but more so the state of mind of where the Imperium is at
mm-hmm.
at that point in time in the Heresy. At this point, they don't care. They can care less
yeah.
about the humanity, right, in order to save humanity. And
yeah.
that's the biggest conundrum or the ironic nature.
Well, because the suffering of one does not overcome the suffering of millions.
Right, but ironically,
it becomes
through
so
their
backwards.
Actions.
Yeah,
yeah exactly. Yeah. And again, getting back to Ingenium, why we think that this is such a great storytelling potential for anyone who's a Mechanicum player out there is because you can get those stories. I mean, what the Cataphron destroyers are, what the entire Plastic Range brings to the tabletop in mm-hmm. 40K in AdMech, and say, hey, all those, that storytelling potential, let's bring that to 30K as well, right? And let's not bend the lore, but let's utilize the lore that's existing in order to further develop the story that's in 30K.
Well, and also on top of that, not to mention, you know, to make it accessible to more people as well. For those people that have their 40K Mechanicum armies, it's like, hey, you know, we want you guys to play as well, right? And you know, sure, I'm sure after, you know, seeing the models for the 30K range, you're probably going to want to pick some of that stuff up too.
I mean, having Cataphron Destroyers with Tech Thralls,
yeah, that'd be so sick. and it's like, it's like, let's expand that and bring that in. And there's nothing that outright says, hey, these don't exist, right? There's nothing that is contradictory. And with the information that we have available, there's no reason that they don't exist. And I think if you look at it from an in-lore perspective, you know, there's some thoughts to say that, hey, this very well could and probably did exist as well.
Right. And so, Ollie, now that you have Ingenium, and Ingenium has been out for a few months now, where's the line going to go from here? What's the storytelling potential that the Panoptica team is looking to go from here?
So there's definitely a couple of units that we're looking at adding already. There's a few on the slightly larger side that maybe some particularly enterprising people might want to convert or 3D print. I'm sure you can figure out what that might be. there are also a bit of a calling to add new weapons to certain units, so maybe a few new knight weapons. But particularly something that's kind of pulled at the back of my mind for a while is how do we represent the Skitarii as they are in Mechanicum, specifically the original depiction of them in Heresy, as the protectors. And so a unit perhaps that represents that version of them, showing them in their most kind of feral warrior form, rather than being the perfectly regimented ranks. What happens when these guys reach the absolute pinnacle of their caste, their kind?
Wow.
Yeah, the feral warrior robots. Like you mentioned, I think that's really cool.
Can you give us a little teaser on that, if you will?
We're thinking something along the lines of a veteran squad, basically.
Veterans.
My goodness.
Yeah, but something that allows you to bring all of these really random and esoteric bits of weaponry in, and a few bits that don't exist anywhere else to represent the fact that these guys are trusted by the higher-ups of the Mechanicum for protecting, literally, the most high-ranking Archmage guy. So they're going to get the best of the best.
Okay, and welcome back to part 3 of this episode. And now we're going to get into, honestly, the most anticipated part of this episode, which is Liber Antiquia. The Eldar is coming to 30K. It's coming to the Horus Heresy. Now, Ollie, what makes this different than all the existing projects that Panoptica's had with Liber Panoptica, Liber Centura, Liber Ingenium? What makes this one different and unique?
So, where the Panoptica, at its core, is new gameplay experiences, like new missions and game modes and stuff, and patches for the game, and the Mechanicum and Marines books that we've done expand existing factions in new and interesting ways, this book is entirely a new faction, a new player to the table, basically. And as such, had to be developed in a very different way. And I think it's really exciting because it means that for the first time, players who maybe aren't as interested in Heresy in terms of, I don't want to play Marines or whatever else, but they've got an Eldar army from 40K, have a door in now.
Right.
And it also presents a new set of challenges for Marines player. Maybe your strategies for building lists now, they ain't going to work properly against the Eldar. You're going to have to try something new. That was kind of the new challenge that it brings.
Right. It breaks the established meta, if you want to call it that, that is currently there.
Yeah, let's call it that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it breaks the established meta. What are some of the ways that you would say that adding in Eldar benefits the game as a whole?
So, as I mentioned, obviously, it changes up the meta, but what I think it does best is it introduces a faction with a lower level of kind of general resilience, but instead you're leaning on your speed now. You have to be fast, so you need to know what your unit's jobs are. You're not particularly multi-role, like Marines, for example. You can take units that'll be good in a couple of situations, and they can be flexible. Eldar are not flexible that same way. They are monotask. They're good at one thing. So get them where they need to be. So that's a unique challenge. And to deal with that is a little bit difficult as well, because their melee units are competent. Their shooting units are competent. So catch them out. Get them in positions where they don't want to be. The other thing about them generally is that their survivability being so lacking means that those weapon choices that most people look at and go, why would I bother with taking a unit of, you know, support marines with heavy bolters? What a pointless choice. Not anymore. You're going to be wounding these guys on twos. Yep. Mess them up.
Well, and it also brings that lore element to life. So, for example, you know, so you're using that, let's use a heavy bolter support squad. 10-man heavy bolter squad.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, why would I bring that in a Horus Heresy game? Right. I mean, obviously, if you want to bring it, if you're playing Imperial Fist, more, that's awesome, right? Because you're getting that plus one BS.
Right.
Dope. Awesome. Right. But now there's more utility to it. And not only is there more utility to it, but there, you got to remember, Marines weren't designed to kill other Marines.
Correct.
That wasn't what they were designed to do during the Great Crusade.
No.
They were designed to kill Xenos.
Mm-hmm.
They were designed to knock out Xenos. So that heavy bolter now has a very real in-life, or I should say in-universe, utilitarian purpose to it, as opposed to, oh, well, it's a quote-unquote cheap option.
Right. No, 100%, and I also think, like, from the in-universe perspective, I believe it is in Angel Exterminatus, there is a scene where Fulgrim fights some Eldar, right? And so I think that, like, that's really cool in my opinion, because it's direct, like, from lore example of the Eldar existing and sort of meddling in the affair, you know, as the Eldar often do, right? They like to meddle, but they're sort of meddling in the affairs of the Imperium of Man, right? And so you can, there's that direct, like, lore link, and to show those different situations where the Eldar are going to be popping in, and it can add a level of uniqueness to the story. And I think, like, kind of referencing what we were saying earlier with campaigns and kind of, you know, battles going on, maybe you're not using a crusade system, but you have, like, an ongoing narrative with your group. What happens 1 week when someone shows up with Eldar? How does that affect the ongoing story for you guys' group?
That's an awesome take. That's a very, because they do go in there and start screwing with the grand schemes of the heresy, and we could see that within 30K a lot. So, for example, if anyone is familiar with the book Butcher's Nails, right, there is a time frame when it was the World Eaters and the Word Bearers, and they were off to go. They were going to start the Shadow Crusade up in Ultramar, and what ended up happening was that. Angron wasn't really playing by the rules. He's like, ah, screw it, I want to do my own thing, right? And Lorgar was like, hey, bro, we gotta get on the roll here. We got a mission to do. Like, why are you meddling with trying to kill everybody,
The difference between chaotic evil and lawful evil.
There you go. That is exactly it. And so, you know, they had a bit of a tussle, and they were about to go to blows with one another. And it wasn't until the Eldar got involved, right? And, you know, because they didn't like, they were like, hey, we can kind of bounce in here and start screwing with the humans.
Mm-hmm.
They had no stake in what was going on as far as, you know, loyalist versus traitor.
Mm-hmm.
They were in it for themselves.
Yep.
Now, having said that, they did meddle and involve themselves within the heresy. And so it would be very cool and very in-universe, you know, bringing to life this universe that we're trying to play, to have that Eldar faction being implemented within your game group, right? We're bringing it to the lore. Now we're bringing it to the LGS, right?
Yeah.
to bring that to life within the tabletop. And we always hear this, is that, oh, well, I don't want to play humans, mm-hmm. right? I want to play Xenos,
yeah,
right?
Well, and for a lot of people, that's a big appeal of Warhammer in general, is right. like the idea of playing these inhuman, you know, Xenos factions that are just like so different from anything that is you know, known within like real life today. And so it's a very legitimate like thing to bring up, is
right.
there are players.
And that's not to take away from that. I mean, that person has a very valid perspective,
exactly.
right? It's like, if someone likes Eldar, mm-hmm. right? I'm not going to like criticize them for saying, oh,
for their
why,
preference.
Yeah, like your preference sucks. Yeah. No, that's not fair, right? I mean, they're cool. I mean, shoot, I played Dark Eldar, mm-hmm. right? When I used to play 40K, I mean, those were my boys, right? Mm-hmm. I love my Dark Eldar. I love my Cabals, right? Those were my boys. And so the idea is that how can I bring that to life within the 30K universe, right? Mm-hmm. To bring it into a game system that actively promotes the storytelling potential of your boys,
yeah.
right? And how can you utilize this, the Xenos, the Eldar in particular, to further enhance the storytelling elements of your story that you're trying to tell within your LGS?
Yeah.
And so, Ollie, I wanted to ask you, as far as, you know, the Eldar, why the Eldar first? Like, I'm curious.
So, it's one of those questions that I've had a couple of times now. Mm-hmm. And having had the time to think about the answer, the truth of the matter is, I wanted to do the Eldar first. But I don't really...
Very fair.
I don't really think I
fair.
Knew that at first. Mm-hmm. When I first looked at them, I looked at, obviously, Orcs, Eldar, to a lesser extent, even Necrons, and some of the lesser sub-factions that I mentioned in the books. Mm-hmm. And I kind of sat there and thought, well, which do I want to do first? Which do I think the team will enjoy doing first?
Right.
And then I realized the Orcs are mentioned actually as more of a setting piece. They're kind of stage dressing. Mm-hmm. So you've got Ul'anor, which is a big, you know, really big pivotal battle, but it's before the Heresy, really. Mm-hmm. So that kind of got discounted in my mind. The Necrons turn up, obviously, in The Infinite and the Divine, mm-hmm. and are spoken about in that book as having been around in the Heresy. But again, that's just background set dressing for that book. So that kind of got discounted a little bit. There's some of the other sub-factions that are described as being around before or during the Heresy, but only ever in brief amounts. But which faction turns up in multiple books, doing stuff during the Heresy, actively interfering? It's the Eldar.
Yeah, that's
so
a really good point.
They were the first pick for that reason.
Right. It's one thing is that it is they are perpetual
nuances in the side of humanity.
They're perpetual thorn in our side. Dang it. No, but it's true. And you bring up a good point, is that they do play a major role for Xenos, mm-hmm. within the Horus Heresy, within the Black Books. You know, you see the Cabal. They are always trying to screw with the plans as that third party. And so, again,
well, I'm just laughing that they decided to meddle with the Alpha Legion, the Legion that claims to be so smart, yet gets meddled with by the Eldar. It is the one that is targeted by the Eldar to be tricked.
Well, I mean, who's tricking who at that point? I mean, let's just trick.
Maybe it was Alpharius the whole time.
Yeah, there you go. But, I mean, yeah. I mean,
it's like five or six levels of, like, I knew that you knew that I knew that you knew. You kind of lose all meaning at that point, right?
I know you. You know you. And I know you know that I know you.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, really, that's what the Eldar and the Eldar trickery brings into the lore. And again, that's, I mean, you see them in the Great Crusade. They're a big part of why we wanted to, or why humanity wanted to get rid of, you know, wanted to purge the universe of Xenos, right? Is because they wanted it, and that was a giant. Them and the Orcs were the two biggest adversaries to the Emperor's goals. And one other thing is that, let's be honest, there's a lot of Eldar players out there,
yeah.
right? There's and every single time, and I'm looking at it from a quote-unquote meta perspective here, you have a lot of people out there that are like, wow, I play Eldar. I play Craftworlders, right? I play Eldari. Why? I want to play your Horus Heresy. I want to play with your Horus Heresy players, right?
Right.
I think it's fair for them to bring their stories into the Heresy, to bring them into 30K, to help develop not only your story within the 30K universe, but to help add that, again, what you were saying, Josh, that nuance.
Mm-hmm. No, 100%. And I also think, like, from the perspective of if you're used to fighting Space Marines, like, you know, this isn't going to come anytime soon from GW, but like the idea of a Great Crusade expansion. And I think like this is almost like a, trying to think of the best word to describe this. It's not a prequel, but it's like a
prequel to the prequel.
It's like a taster, right?
Mm-hmm. A teaser.
Yeah. Teaser. It's like a teaser of the Great Crusade, right? When you're able to fight against the Eldar, and like, particularly after the battle between Fulgrim and the Emperor's Children with the Eldar and them fighting during Angel Exterminatus, it's like, this is something that happened. And we see, and like, I always go back to, okay, we see this one recorded story, but what are the 20, 30, 40 plus other stories that we don't see recorded within the Horus Heresy? When did the Eldar show up to do something specific to change the course of this pseudo history,
right,
that isn't even noted because it's just missed, right? And so, and you know, telling those stories is really cool, mm-hmm, right? And then it's also from the perspective of, like, from a non-in-universe perspective, it's also just really fun to fight aliens, right? And if you play Eldar, then right, you like being the wise, like, special boys who, you know, have the greater knowledge and greater understanding than the Mon Kai, right? And so you get to play out that and fight off the brutish Space Marines. Or if you want to play the brutish Space Marines, like, you know, sure, do your best to kill the alien. Like,
right.
It's a win-win situation.
Right. Right, exactly. As far as you playing on the tabletop.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And so one thing I would like to bring up to a question I'd like to bring to you, Ollie, is what is actually being presented for those who haven't gone through the Liber Antiquia book yet? What is it that's actually being brought? Is it the entire Eldar range? Is it part of it? Is there new units? Are some things taken out? What are we looking at here?
So what we're looking at is a complete conversion of the Craftworlds army, as they might have looked around the time just immediately post-fall, as well as a small-scale version of the Harlequins army, in a much cut-down form to what people are probably used to, but still in its... in its ability to fight, it's not diminished, but it's just in a much smaller kind of formation. The Azoyani, the Craftworld Eldar, having been only recently introduced to this lore, one of the developers' notes actually that I wrote was, this way of war is new to them, and they hate it.
Hmm.
They are not happy about being forced to fight in this way as being a Craftworld militia. The aspects are new and haven't bedded in yet into their culture, not truly. Bear in mind, these are people who live for thousands of years. They are used to things being able to take as long as they need to take. So 200 years since the fall for them at this point, it's the blink of an eye, and they're right, not happy about how things have changed. As a result, you've got things like Guardian Officer cadres as an elite's choice, where you can take some officers to scatter into your Guardian squads. You take enough of them and it becomes a free force organization slot choice rather than being a paid one. So the more you lean into the Guardian aspect, the more your army starts to actually just accept that that's how things are done.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to take aspects, you have to buy aspect exarchs to unlock those aspect units. You want to make use of, you know, certain other abilities. You've got to lean into that to make it work. You also have things like world runes, which are effectively rites of war for the Eldar. So there's a lot of stuff you can lean into, but the Eldar way of war here, it rewards you for doing so. I also touched on it briefly, but the Seadath, the Harlequins, the lore for those guys kind of implies that they're not really seen outside the Webway until quite a way after the Heresy, not in any great numbers at least, and not in a true performance.
Mm-hmm.
So what we decided to do quite early on in their design kind of decision was that they should be bound to performances only. So you take them instead of an allied detachment, it actively replaces an allied detachment. But you purchase a Sedathi detachment, a grand performance.
A Sedathi and then is a...
That's the name for the Harlequins that's given in law. The Sedath, the Sedathi.
Got it.
So you purchase one of those, and it's a grand performance, and it'll tell you your key players, your key performers are these units. And you have optional roles that are these units. And you pay the same points for them, but it locks you into certain choices. And
so
gives
very
you
limited.
Unique... Yes, but it gives you unique objectives that can score you additional victory points if you complete them. Huh. But the amateur performance special rule also kicks in, so you fail to achieve that, you're giving your opponent VPs instead.
Huh. So what you're doing is you're allowing the player to have all the options available to them. So let's say you want to play Assyriani, or you want to play that Eldar, that Craftworlder aspect of things, but at the same time, you want to bring in some of the quote-unquote new elements of the Harlequins, you can do that. You have the utility to do so, but at the same time, there are some limitations as to how they operate in lore within that time frame that you have to then...
Like abide by.
Yeah, exactly. You have to abide by.
And I think more than that, what I find really cool is like this is a... I think of the world or word bearers unit, right? That it's like a special, has a lot of apothecaries, kind of a weird, obscure unit, but you get victory points for wiping a squad because it's these apothecaries going out and they're taking the gene seed of the opponents. It's a very specific goal. You need to sweep an enemy unit in close combat, right? That's very narrow, right? There's one thing you can do to get this VP. However, if you lose them because they're so key to the recruitment process of the word bearers, you lose VP. So it's like taking that idea of a unique unit, but you're expanding, and my assumption is that was maybe part of your goal, is like, we want to have instead of a unit that grants and loses VP, we want to have a detachment that grants and loses VP.
Correct, yeah. And I will be honest with you, every time I look back at, you know, the naming convention we went for amateur performance, it does give me a little bit of a laugh, because it's just so comical to me. Like, this is clearly an Imperial scholar who's learned everything he can when he's writing about these people.
Right.
Going, well, these guys clearly were very, very good because they killed a lot of things, but they seemed to have some goal that they wanted to achieve and they failed to do it. And we heard them muttering about how it's a bunch of, you know, bloody amateurs and all this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So that would be kind of how they would perceive it, how the Imperials would perceive this
from
attack.
From an intel perspective.
Yeah, from this strange, colourful host of Eldar, that they have no idea what these guys are about. But from the Eldar perspective, it's because they just weren't good enough at that performance yet. It's not ready yet. So it was an amateur performance. So that's where it would come from.
No, that's brilliant.
That's freaking sick, dude.
The respect that you have for the lore and the intentionality behind how you guys go about doing stuff is really inspiring. I think it's really cool.
And so that's bringing in the Harlequins, right? Is there any other element? So I know we talked about the Sirianni and the Harlequins, but there's another element to them as well, correct? With the Corsairs. Explain how the Corsairs operate within the 30K universe and how you brought that to life in Antiquia.
So there's a lot of little lore hints that we give about the state of the Corsair, the Anorath. We are planning to do something with them in future, so there will be something a bit more full-fledged than just little lore mentions eventually. But our kind of gut feel around them is actually a lot inspired by Oster Ike, who we had some quite long conversations with. And Antiquia is kind of our mark of respect, our letter of appreciation to Oster Ike's fantastic work. And I've said it before in a few places, I'll say it again very openly here. I'm really grateful for all of the time that he had for us, and I cannot thank him enough.
Mm-hmm.
But what we kind of looked at was, how would those Corsair fleets have become Corsair fleets? Well, the Eldar military machine at its apex, at its peak, wouldn't have been self-supporting the same way the Craft Worlds were. It would have relied upon Eldar Worlds for its resupply and its maintenance and its manpower. So at some point during the fall, those military fleets would have been cut off from everything they needed to operate. And when you have a bunch of very capable military personnel left without resources and supplies, there's not going to be long left before they turn to piracy. Yeah. They're going to start taking what they need.
Yep.
So, the Eldar, the Anarath, the military might, becomes Anarath, the Corsair fleets. And that's what we're trying to hint at here. This is not long after the fall, so their military might is still largely intact. The Ghost Warriors that performed kind of the military duty have started to have their shells repurposed into being the Wraith units, but the Anarath is still out there, maybe in a diminished state, but still exists. And I think that it wouldn't be any secret for me to say we are intending to go back and look at those as a sub-faction at some point.
That's awesome. Yeah, I really like that.
Yeah.
And again, looking back at the intentionality, what you said, Josh, the intentionality behind that is that you look at, let's say, within history, right? You see units that have been a part of a fighting force, right? They're a part, whether they be a PMC, a private military contractor, or they're a part of an actual military organizational force as part of a like some sort of country or whatnot, right?
Right, right.
And then that country falls apart, right? Or that contract kind of goes into disarray.
Yeah.
Right? And what happens to that force?
Well, look at the Roman legions.
Right, yeah.
Right. During the fall of Rome, you had if my history knowledge serves me correct, I believe the first sacking of Rome was under Alaric the Visigoth.
Right, the Visigoths.
Alaric the Visigoth.
Right, right.
Who was a commander of a Roman legion.
Well, yeah, a Roman legion, but it was an auxiliary legion. But yeah, yes, right. That's exactly it. It was when they go, what happens when they go rogue?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so, you can use very recent history with the Wagner Group, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it was, hey, we weren't getting what we were owed to me. Whatever, I'm not going to get into modern politics. They felt that they were wronged, and they pushed on to Moscow, right? There is an innumerable amount of situations within history, as recent as a couple of weeks ago, and as far back as, you know, ancient times, right, where you can look at what happens to a fighting force when they no longer have an objective,
right?
When their objectives are fulfilled, or when maybe they're not fulfilled.
Even when you take like say really any country and you take away the stability for the majority of like the fighting age males, that results in revolution every single time.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what happens with the fall of the Eldar, is that level of stability for the, you know, like the fighting age Eldar, right? for them to, that stability is lost. And so it's like they're going to go rogue.
Right.
And that's guaranteed.
Right. Exactly. And to back that up, so there, if you look at someone named Abzurbelvect, he's like the kind of the main Dark Eldar baddie in 40K, right? One big thing about him is that he was on the sacrificial altar within the Webway.
Okay.
And then the fell happened as just before he was sacrificed.
Right.
Right. One big thing about that is that you start to see that was their society. That was, I like to think that Kamara was their, Kamara was the Eldar Vegas, if that makes any sense. You know, that was their little, like, hey, we go, things are pretty screwed up already, but then we go to Kamara if we
Capua.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it's Capua. Yeah. That's their Capua, that's their Vegas. That's where they go to do, you know, their society screwed up, but let's take it a step further, sort of thing, right? And so when that no longer is, when their society then collapses, right? That's when She Who Thirsts, Slaanesh, gets awoken at that point, right? Mm-hmm. Then you start to, and you know, when Abzurbelvect was at the altar, right? You start to see how does a society collapse from there, and what's their baseline?
Yeah.
What do they default to?
Yep.
Right? And so going back to Panoptica, seeing that in real time, quote unquote real time, within the context of the heresy, and then bringing that to life on the tabletop, right? As you are playing your games or as you're playing your campaign, how does that look like? And how can you make that a compelling point of your story?
Right.
Yeah, that's the thing. Like, we wrote everything. The Eldar book started life on the 11th of December. That's when we started.
Mm-hmm.
But it had been in its concepting phase for a little bit before that. Like, we wrote the first unit on the 11th of December, but we'd been doing concept work for about a month before. Mm-hmm. So by the time it came out, it had been in progress for over 6 months.
So there's a
lot. It's a long time period to work on it.
So there's a lot of thought processes that went into this. So it's not just something that is like, oh, off the cuff. You want Eldar? Screw it. We're going to give you Eldar. There's a lot of thought process. Actually, get into the concept of what it took to make Eldar in 30K and that process from porting them from either 7th edition from their latest iteration or from 9th edition and 10th edition. How did you merge that gap?
So a lot of the times, let's say we'll pick a certain unit. We'll pick out Shadow Spectres.
Mm-hmm.
We would start with a concept and we'd go, okay, so what do these guys actually do? What's their job? How are they represented in 7th edition or 6th edition or, you know, the earliest version of their rules where they exist? Okay, how has that evolved all the way up to 9th edition? Okay. Does that feel consistent? Is there inconsistencies? Is there changes? Okay, so which version of that are we taking forward? So we would strip everything down to, you know, the base concept, and then we'd build it back up with all the layered pieces of everything that we feel like makes that unit what it is, from all different editions that it's represented in different ways, and then start to tweak that so that it actually comes together and works properly. Once we had all of that built up, it would then be kind of a case of, do those rules actually feel cohesive? Is it one consistent design for that unit? Okay, now it can go to testing. But before that point, before that stage, we'd already done all the groundwork to concept up the Eldar list. So the first unit we wrote was Guardian Defenders. We started with them really early into the design process. So we did a conversation about what should their strength and toughness values be? 3. They're about physically the same as a human.
Right.
Well, how many wounds should they have on average? Well, 1, they're like a human. Fine. But what should their movement stat be? 7, they're like Space Marines, they're quick. Their initiative then, well, they're faster than Space Marines. They move quicker on their feet than even a Space Marine does. 5 initiative.
Right.
What's their basic armor save? They're using mesh armor. It's 5s. So that was kind of the kind of design conversations we were having around them. And like, weapon skill is skill. These are still Guardian Militia that have trained for 200 years, even if they are Guardian Militia. 4s. So that was the design process.
Hmm.
And the end outcome of each of those kind of processes was that we had a nice consistent design that then each of the writers on the team, you know, who got involved in writing the project, could pick up that nice consistent philosophy of this is how these units should feel. This is the design style that we're going to go for when we build a unit. Split out, write a unit each, come together and discuss their units that everyone's written, go again. And once those units were written, they went off to play testers. So the people who wrote them weren't testing them. So there was no designer bias.
Right.
And that's how we got everything out there.
And I like that there's no designer bias. Yeah, that is a really very key. Big key with what your process. And that's not just with Eldar. This is with everything y'all do. Correct me if I'm wrong.
It absolutely is. You bang on the money. It was a process that we started after we'd finished Centura, where we didn't allow the person who'd written something to test it, but it kind of happened organically with Centura. We kind of just enforced it more from Ingenium onwards because it was easier to enforce with something like that. But to avoid designer bias, to avoid I know what I mean issues and so on, where
yeah.
I've written a rule, so of course I know how it's supposed to work.
Right.
To avoid those, you give it to somebody who wasn't involved. And then you see, can they understand? Do they get it? Does it make sense to them? And then you remove some of that bias.
Yeah, and I really like that. I really like how that process is, hey, you know what? If you wrote this rule, if you partook of the rules writing process of X unit, you have no say in the editing process of that. That way it keeps everything genuine. It keeps you're not
it's untainted by personal like belief.
That's exactly it. And so going forward, what can we expect from Panoptica, and in particular with the Eldar range and anything moving forward from there?
Okay, so to start with the Eldar, one of the big things we're looking at doing is obviously there's one major faction that's missing. By the time of M40, they would have been called the Drakkari. At this point, they are the High Lords of the Dark Eldar, the languishes in the Webway. So we're going to look at those guys at some point. But there are also two Eldar sub-factions that need some attention, which are, of course, the Anorath and the Exodites. So those guys get some attention.
There are so many people, if our community is a representation in any way of the larger community of the Horus Heresy, everyone wants the Exodites. I'm sure you guys are well aware.
Base elves riding dinosaurs, let's go, bro.
Absolute madness, yeah. So those are the things we're looking at for Eldar. Generally speaking, that's probably a way out because we have some other projects we're doing first.
Right.
Honestly, if I was to draw a rough roadmap, there is a secret project that is on the horizon that we have teased on the Discord that I won't say what that is right now. That's probably not as far away as people think, but isn't due for immediate release in the next couple of weeks. That aside, though, that's going to just kind of be a drops when it drops job. The next big project we are doing is Imperial. And will constitute a lot of big additions to the various Imperial factions. So people who play Solar Auxilia, Imperialis Militia, Custodes, and Sisters of Violence, you're going to see some interesting additions in the near future. We're hoping to have that out in a couple of months, but it takes, unfortunately, as with all things, as long as it takes.
We have to do due diligence.
Yeah.
Right. You'd rather have a usable, you know, playset than something that's there immediately now. And hey, it sucks though.
There's a general level of quality that I think the team in general wants to maintain. And you know, I really press for that, but I don't have to because the team, I'm always impressed by the dedication they've got. Always. Nobody on the team wants to put out a product that's not to scratch. And everybody wants to be involved in doing something for it. There are people on that team who are so dedicated at writing lore, like they'll sit there and they'll hammer out, you know, 10 entries a day, and I'm impressed. Like when they're going, yeah, I've done, you know, I've done 1,000 words in an hour, and I go, okay, all right, cool, that's fine. And then there are some people on the team who will come back to me and say, I've written 10 units today because I had a day off work. Great, fantastic. Okay, let's get them out to the testers. That's kind of the thing that's going on there. I mean, there are weeks sometimes at a time where every single evening I'll be spending on a call with, you know, three or four of the writers saying, what are we doing about this? How are we handling this? Is this moving? Is the status this good? So there's a lot of really hard work that goes into it, and we wouldn't want to release something subpar.
That's awesome.
To kind of circle round though, once Imperials are kind of done, we are looking at potentially doing Orcs first and then looking at other stuff. Like maybe an Eldar V2. But before that happens, we are also looking at potentially Mechanicum and Marines additions. So there could be more of that to come as well.
Awesome.
Excellent.
Awesome. And again, any 30K content out there that helps tell that story would be absolutely awesome. You know, for telling that narrative, for, you know, bringing that to life within the tabletop at your respective gaming store. So again, if you are a Horus Heresy player, wherever you're at in your gaming group, I'd highly recommend checking out the Panoptica group and checking out their PDF. So before we sign off here, Ollie, where can they find these documents and where can they get a hold of you and get a hold of the Panoptica rule set in general?
So all of the Panoptica documents are all available via Itch. We have a page on there. Everything's kept up to date. So the versions that are downloadable there are up to date as of the time of download, basically. And We do regular updates with change notes on there as well. So everything's there, everything's logged. If people want to get hold of us, they want to give us feedback or just chat with us or even just be involved in the Heresy community in general, we actually have a really big Discord, which is the HH Age of Darkness Discord server. We try and keep it a really pleasant place to be and keep everybody enthused for the hobby. So, yeah, we welcome anybody to join us.
And all the links to the Panoptica project will be in the notes to this podcast, as well as a invite link to their Discord server as well will also be in this podcast, the podcast notes as well. So, Ollie, I want to say thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to talk to us today. And again, getting us hyped up for the Heresy, hyped up for new things that are going to be coming around the corner for the Horus Heresy, for 30K, and also bringing that to life to, again, help flesh out that story that they want to tell.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really have much to add there, but again, excellent work. Really respect everything that you do and the intentionality behind it. I think it's incredibly clear to anyone looking through you guys' work that you take it very seriously, and particularly treating it at, you know, with something like a hobby, you know, tremendous kudos to you guys. Awesome work.
Yeah, well, thank you very, very much to Perry for having me on and for all the very kind things you've said. I really do appreciate it, and it's always a pleasure. So thank you.
All right, so that was quite an episode, man. You know, talking about everything that has to do with the with Panoptica, the latest mm-hmm. projects they have to do, the mission sets, what Ingenium is all about, bringing Mechanicum to 30K, the entire 40K range, as well as bringing Eldar to 30K as well. What resonated with you as far as the episode, now as we're kind of doing a recap of that?
No, 100%. So I think definitely the biggest thing is being very open-minded when it comes to additions onto the Horus Heresy game system, right? Like, you know, we have the core rules. You know, Heresy as it stands right now doesn't have a Crusade system. But,
right.
You know, having these additions that can really flesh stuff out. Again, it's, you know, it's really what Panoptica does so great. You know, the 12 additional rule, I'm sorry, not rules, but the 12 additional game modes, right? I think that's a huge addition. The adding of the 40K, you know, Adeptus Mechanicus range into the 30K Mechanicum range, and, you know, using those for your armies, you know, fleshing out with more units, adding in additional options, like that only stands to benefit. And then, of course, adding the Eldar in, like whether you're an Eldar player who wants to be the Xenos or you're the Space Marine player that wants to purge the Xenos, it doesn't matter, like, you know, which side of the coin you're on in that regard, it's going to be a good time. And you can really only benefit from adding those type of things in.
Right, exactly. And one thing that you said that really resonated with me was mm-hmm. it stands to benefit.
Yes.
It's one thing that, okay, hey, it's not like they're trying to be a, oh, you can and cannot do something, mm-hmm. right? It's a very open discussion. It's something that's it's something that's designed to ensure that the story that you want to tell within your community, it's giving you those tools to tell it.
Exactly.
Right? Especially with the Crusade system and all that jazz. One thing that, a book that I've been absolutely enamored with as of late, it's called Diceman. It's the origin story of Games Workshop. I 100% highly recommend it. It's been a page turner for me, especially for anyone that's within this community. And we're not sponsored by it in any way, shape, or form. I think it's a freaking fantastic book, but it's about the origin story of Games Workshop and how they came to be as a store and and how that turned into what they are today as a conglomerate of what they are today.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I find interesting about this is that Games Workshop originally started as a small D&D shop.
Right.
That's it. It was yep. just a D&D shop.
It was your LGS.
Yeah, it was your literally your just your local gaming store where you got to BS with your friends. And one thing is that I kind of feel that, you know, a lot of times you get into the nuts and bolts of Warhammer. Oh, well, you know, the rules state XYZ, so you can't do blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Right? I don't really like the word can't.
Mm-hmm.
I like the word, well, what can you do?
Mm-hmm.
What can you do within this space? What can you do to tell your narrative, to tell your story, to tell the story of your boys, mm-hmm. or to tell the story of your community?
Right.
Let's look beyond just you. Let's look at what your story is. Let's look at the story of your boys, your meta boys, the guys that you go to the LGS with and you hang out with,
mm-hmm.
right, and that you throw dice with. What is the story of the community that you make, mm-hmm. right? And how can you invigorate that story and elaborate on said story? To me, what Panoptica is a tool to help you tell that story.
Yep.
Now, whether you like that tool or not, that's entirely up to you. If
right.
you say, hey, this is awesome, or hey, I just don't like it.
Yeah, this doesn't fit, and it might not fit the needs of some people, and that's fine.
Exactly. But the thing is that it is a tool it's an option that's available to you if you decide that you want to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I highly encourage anyone who's listening to this podcast to go, hey, you know what? You want an extra tool? Give it a go. Look yep. at it. And you know what? If you like the missions, but you don't like the Xenos,
you don't have to use them.
Exactly. You don't want any of the stuff. Hey, I don't want the Centura stuff. I don't want the Ingenium stuff. I don't want the Eldar, but I do want the Panoptica. I do want the extra missions. I do want the extra
the
rules.
FAQs, that type of stuff. You can pick and choose what it is that works for you.
Exactly. Who's to say what you can and can't use? It's up to you. It's your guys' community. It's your guys' quote-unquote D&D community, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm.
You guys make the story that you want to tell. Tell the narrative that you want to tell for your community to embellish it and to develop a stronger, more cohesive community together with your friends.
100%. And Dan, where can they get a hold of you with your business with OSPS?
Awesome. So if you're looking into anything for Oil Spill Painting Studio, as far as painting any of your miniatures and whatnot, again, our team with Oil Spill Painting Studio, what we do is we talk to you about what models you want to get painted, whether it's within the Heresy, 40K, any other game system. We try to not just paint the models that you want to paint. You know, hey, what do you want painted? We know this color and that color and the other one, and you know, call it a day. We actually want to get into why you paint what you paint. You know, mm-hmm. what's the story behind your boys?
And then how can you show that with the paint job?
Exactly. And we want to embellish that. We don't bring that to life. So what we do with me and my team, you know, it's me and a handful of other painters. What we try to do is we try to tell that story on the tabletop, the story that you want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
As as you're commissioning us to do so, we want to bring your story to life on the tabletop. So if that interests you as far as bringing your miniatures to life on the tabletop, be sure to get a hold of us at oilspillpaintingstudio@gmail.com. You can get a hold of us also on Instagram and Facebook at oilspillpaintingstudio as well.
All right, so as far as feedback, you guys know where you can reach us as far as on our Instagram, on our Facebook page. Feel free to send us a message, comment on any of our updates and whatnot that we post as well. We'd love to hear back from, you know, whoever has different feedback. And, you know, we do our best to get back in touch with everybody and let them know how we're perceiving their messages. Well, and a big goal of ours as well is like sharing the vision of how we see the Heresy. So, you know, chances are if you're someone who agrees with us, who's a listener of ours, then you probably see the Heresy the same way. So if you are looking to share that vision with others, you know, we definitely encourage you to share our videos with them as well, particularly when it comes to using, you know, elements of history to inspire your people, right? Using elements of, you know, lore building and that creative thinking to go about inspiring and creating your army. These are great references, and that's kind of what we try and do, is, you know, give like ammunition almost for you guys to help build the communities in your local area and share the common vision that we have.
Well, that about does it for us here at the Iterators Podcast. So as always, my name is Daniel
and I'm Josh,
and we'll see you next time.